You know, I know that you've written a book called The Self-Esteem Book, The Ultimate Guide to Boosting the Most Important Ingredient for Success and Happiness in Life. Yeah, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that book. And, you know, I talk about self-confidence as being the first real key to success for anybody. And you talk about self-esteem as being the most important ingredient for success. I'd love to just get a quick overview of the book and, you know, your general thoughts on both self-esteem and self-confidence.
Well, sure, absolutely, bud. Self-confidence is very closely tied to self-esteem. And the way I see it, it's actually one of the essential components that someone possessing high self-esteem has. There's really four areas that measure what high self-esteem is all about. The first is personal power, and that's our ability to influence others. And so obviously, if we're going to be able to influence others powerfully, it will also behoove us to have great self-confidence. The second is significance, which is our ability to be accepted and have the attention and the affection of others. So we have to feel as though we're important to other people, that they love us, that they care about us, that they want to be around us. And again, we're confident when that takes place as well. The third is virtue, meaning that we have to feel good about ourselves morally, that we're a good person. We can't go around thinking that we're just a jerk, that we're doing things always that make us feel poorly about ourselves. So when we feel like we're living in alignment with our values, that's when we're virtuous and that's when we have high self-esteem. And then fourthly, and this is the larger area, is the area of competence. And that's the ability to produce a result and to be in control of our lives. And that is in all six areas of life, in our health and appearance, our occupation and our finances, our wealth and our business, our family and relationships, personal and spiritual development, and lastly, and also very important, is the area of fun and recreation and the ability to pursue our passions. So self-esteem is kind of the overwhelming umbrella concept as I see it, and self-confidence really reinforces many of those areas that make up someone with high self-esteem.
That's great. Just real quickly, what are the four again?
Well, the six areas of life or the
four? The four areas of self-esteem.
They are personal power,
personal
significance,
power,
virtue, and competence.
That's great. I love it when the way you've broken them down into these categories. You know, the one that kind of jumps out at me a little bit is virtue. Sometimes, you know, you run into people who seem to feel pretty good about themselves, and they seem to be pretty successful, but yet at the same time, they kind of almost know that they're jerks, you know, in the way they conduct their life and their business. How does that square with your idea of virtue?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of people aren't really totally in tune with their values. And so they live lives that are in direct opposition to their values. They violate those values. And so they get to feel poorly about who they are. So maybe they're dishonest. Maybe they're people that are constantly lying and abusing others. And although they're effective in what they're doing, they get away with it, for example, deep down inside they know that it's not the thing to do, but they see the world as scarcity and they feel like in order to survive, that's one of the only ways they can do so. So they sacrifice an important element like virtuosity in order to survive and to get ahead because they mistakenly feel that that's the only way that they can do it.
That's very interesting. So when you talk about the idea of scarcity, you're talking about the zero-sum game, the whole notion that if I win, somebody else has to, by definition, lose.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, most of the world is tied into that concept, and that's why we have competition and negotiation, and we have I win, you lose, you win, I lose mentality that has us live in a dog-eat-dog world.
Yeah, it's a tough way to look at things because it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. It's been kind of interesting the past couple evenings as I've been watching a little bit of the Olympics. Obviously, there's the athletic competition and there is a win-lose, but there certainly seems to be enough controversy this year around this whole notion of win-lose and nationalism and all sorts of stuff like that.
Well, you know, our culture has been based upon the whole concept of nationalism. Our country is better than your country. Our profession is better than your profession. Our college is better than your college. And, you know, competition is good to the extent that it helps people to push themselves to be better. And it's bad in that it has them try to win at the expense of other people. It eliminates the concept of empathy, which is what is it like in the other person's world such that we can understand their behavior, their actions, such that we can appreciate that they're doing the best they can, and we can look for ways that we can synergize with them so that our efforts and their efforts are greater than our individual efforts separately. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with sports. Sports are great. Competitions are great. And, you know, the thing that's really important is to know that they're all winners and that they're all competing there because they've all achieved success. So there are no losers in the games. There are only they're only coming together in the name of mutuality and camaraderie and sportsmanship and trying to bring countries together as opposed to dividing them.
Yeah, it was very interesting watching the one of the women's gymnastics where two of the young women actually had the same score, and then instead of giving two gold medals, they used some very bizarre tiebreak kind of formula that kind of artificially forced one person to get the gold and the other person to get the silver. And my wife and I were just talking about it, saying, well, why didn't they just give two golds when they had the exact same score? And I think that gets at a lot of what you're talking about here in terms of scarcity.
Well, they do, and, you know, how is it better that one person has to lose for the other person to win?
Yeah, exactly.
Why can't they both win? It's just, and we look at our business decisions that way. You know, someone asked me, I was interviewing for someone to support me with my business. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions that he asked me was, do you do any research on your competitors? And I was really I had a smile because I don't have any competitors. I just have people that I partner with because I don't see that if, let's take the topic of self-esteem, which I'm considered to be an expert on. If someone else speaks about self-esteem, they're an ally of mine because they're partnering with me in my vision to help elevate the consciousness of the planet by enhancing people's self-esteem. So it's not that they're going to sell their self-esteem program and I'm not going to sell mine, because that's just foolish. The idea that there's only a limited number of people that are purchasers, for example, of any commodity is a lie. There's plenty of people, there's plenty of demand for anything that you have as long as you can provide value for it, as long as you can contribute to people's lives. And so that's the place, from my perspective, to look, as opposed to looking to be a little bit better than the other guy so that you can cut him out of his profits.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because people who are interested in material and self-esteem are probably interested in yours, my thoughts, and several other people's thoughts who write and think about it, and that the idea that people are going to we're going to say, I'm going to choose the one set of ideas on self-esteem, is actually, when you think about it, even sounds kind of foolish and odd, but yet there are people who will define relationships as competitors. And it's all up to us, because I guess you and I could define our relationship as either competitors or collaborators, and I think we both are more likely to define it as a collaborative rather than a competitive relationship.
Well, absolutely. There's no gain in us being adversaries or competitors. Again, you are likely to gain more with my support, and I'm likely to gain more with yours than we are if we oppose each other. And that is true, I would say, in 100% of the situations, if people would start to shift their paradigm around cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that kind of brings us back to, you know, business. And sometimes I think that, you know, self-esteem, particularly low self-esteem, can really affect somebody who's in business. You know, and how does it affect, you know, people in their business lives? And is it something that you see a lot of?
Well, we see it pervasively. It affects business people predominantly in two ways. The first way is that people having low self-esteem hide out. They play small. They fear failing. And as a result, they're afraid to take risks. So they don't play for the gold medal. They play for the bronze medal because it's safer. They can not get hurt. And people with low self-esteem have it that the world is a dangerous place and that they don't have enough tools to win in that world. So what they have to do is protect themselves at all times. So in business, what that looks like is doing whatever it takes to protect themselves and keep the status quo in place as opposed to having breakthrough results.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other way that it affects business people typically is that those who feel that they're not good enough, unworthy, are out to prove that they are. And so they will be on rails. And what I mean by that is like a train that is absolutely going 1,000 miles an hour in the direction of their goal. And there's nothing wrong with being motivated, but when it reaches a driven status where no matter what they achieve is never good enough because the satisfaction is never lasting. They might get a raise. They might get a promotion. They might get a new title. Whatever that is for them that they're striving for, it might have some temporary satisfaction for a day or two, but pretty soon they're back on that train looking to go to the next level because they hold it that there's something wrong with themselves. So no matter what they can accomplish, they'll never achieve that standard of perfection that they're going for. And, of course, as we all know, that's unattainable. And it's excellence that we want, not perfection.
So the latter type of person you're describing almost could never sort of savor the moment or his or her accomplishments.
Yeah, there's no happiness there. There's no fulfillment. There's no sense of accomplishment because they are constantly invalidating themselves no matter what they do.
Yeah. And might that kind of go back to when we were talking before about being virtuous, that sometimes they may sort of adopt this win-at-all-cost mentality that might lead them to, you know, make some shortcuts and cut some corners and therefore lose some of their virtuosity?
Absolutely. What they do is they sacrifice the values that are really at heart important to them for other values. In this case, accomplishing a goal, they might sacrifice their morals. They might sacrifice the things that they know are important, and so then they feel poorly about who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And they might justify it and hide it to the best of their ability, but deep down, they're nagged by it. Other people react to what they see them doing, so they damage their relationships. And the irony is that they get further from where they want to be, even though they're so driven to get there because they're not in alignment with the spiritual laws of attraction and success, then they never achieve the things that they want because of this self-sabotage.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, to go back to the first type of person, it's, you know, I always feel badly when I run into people who have these sort of like countdown to retirement calendars that, you know, where sometimes they're 3 years out and they're crossing off every day. And it's almost like I come to work and it's such a chore and I dislike it so much and I can't leave because I'm locked in because of my pension plan and this and that. And I never got, you know, the promotions that I thought I deserved. And sometimes I think these are the people that are a little bit like you were describing at first that seem to not take the risk, so they sometimes settle for maybe less than they could have achieved or some mediocrity and then almost end up being sad and resentful at the end of their careers because of they never took the risk and never achieved.
Absolutely. That's a great example. People sacrifice their happiness, their relationships, their fulfillment. They lose sight of their passions. They're not in touch with their gifts. They don't know that they can declare a life purpose. All of the things that make life worth living, they give up with instead choosing to be resigned, to live in that resignation of playing it safe because their perspective is that they can get hurt. They can, if they risk it all, they can lose. They'll have nothing. So they stay in that dead-end job. They stay doing day after day the things that they hate the most. They say that life will be great when X happens, in this case, when they retire. And then what they see is that because they've been so accustomed to resignation all their lives, they've forgotten how to live full out. They've forgotten their passions. And so when they do retire, what they have to look forward to is sitting in front of the TV set for the next 10 years until they pass on, because they just haven't developed the passions, the relationships, the things that make life vivid and vibrant. And so when they retire, they lose their focus, and so many people die shortly afterward.
Yeah, it's very sad. I mean, I know that, you know, I mean, the whole Social Security system was based on the fact that people would work to 65 and then probably pass on at 66 or 67. That was sort of the actuarial ideas behind it. And I think that was true, particularly when people had more mundane, jobs where they worked more with their backs than they did with their minds.
That's absolutely correct.
So, when you talk about, when you say pervasive, that's a strong word. And I'm not to put numbers to it, but is it like 80%, 90%, 60%? I mean, pervasive, I mean, to me, means a lot. And that's actually kind of scary that there's a lot of people in business who are walking around with low self-esteem. I mean, in your experience, how do you define pervasive, or what leads you to use that term?
Well, over the last 17 years, I've literally coached thousands of people, personally, one-on-one, and in groups. Mm-hmm. And what I've found is that more than 85% of those people, conservatively speaking, lack self-esteem in one or more of those ways that we described earlier.
85?
So 85-plus percent, meaning that mm-hmm. less than 15% would be considered as having high self-esteem in those six areas of life, feeling that like they have personal power, that they're significant, that they're virtuous, and that they're competent. Mm-hmm. So typically people are doing well, fairly well, in some areas and lacking self-esteem in others. And mm-hmm. some people have situational self-esteem where they might feel really competent in business, but maybe they are socially inept. Maybe they're terrible in their relationships. Maybe they lack intimacy, whatever that is, or vice versa. So mm-hmm. people can have lacking self-esteem in more than one area, or it can be confined to, you know, just one or two areas.
So it can be situational.
Situational is when they are in with friends, for example.
Yeah.
They're confident. They feel good about who they are. They can relate adequately. When they go to a party and they know no one, they sit in the corner and they just are stricken with fear. So in that situation, they have low self-esteem because they're afraid to meet people, they're afraid to risk, they're afraid to have people discover that they're a fraud, which is just an example of what they might be thinking about themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that, you know, I mean, I can identify areas where I feel better about myself than I do in some other areas. And as you're talking, like, you know, like 85% of people, that's a big number, and so where does this come from? I mean, what is the origin, I guess, of low self-esteem?
Well, it all happens when we're a young child, typically between the ages of 0 and 6, but it can happen even a little later, up until 12, where mm-hmm. the world is going along well, and all of a sudden something happens. Someone says or does something, and one of two things can transpire. Either they insult us, maybe it's a bullying episode, a spanking, it's a derogatory comment, it's some assault to have us see that there's something unworthy, unlovable about us, not good enough, somehow that we're defective. We don't live up to that paradigm of perfection that we see where everyone else is better than we are in some way. The other thing that can happen is it can be an absolute innocent comment that is not meant to deride our self-esteem at all. But what we do is we interpret what someone says or does in a way that we make it personal. So someone says, they say something like, I can't come out today because I have to do work. And what the person who's 5 years old thinks, she doesn't like me. So she's not coming out because she doesn't want to play with me. And she doesn't want to play with me because I'm ugly, or I'm fat, or I'm thin, or whatever the person sees as their defect. So they take an innocent remark, or they take an action that someone does, and they interpret it in a way where it's about them. So from that perspective onward, they start to build evidence that what they've decided about themselves is true. So now they look at the next possible upset, and they, let's say that the child makes up that they're ugly. That someone says, let's say that that they're picking sides for a volleyball game, and the person gets picked last. Mm-hmm. Well, that person might make up that they're ugly, nobody likes them, that they aren't any good, whatever they make up. So now what they do is they go through life scanning for situations to reinforce that initial meaning that they gave to why they're defective or they're unlovable or they're not good enough. And they will not only scan for, but they will actually manifest and create those situations just to be right about what they've decided. And after dozens and hundreds and thousands of these episodes over the decades, before you know it, they're absolutely convinced that they're defective in that way and that they now need to protect themselves. And they can protect themselves aggressively, offensively. They can protect themselves defensively by hiding out. They can protect themselves in so many different ways that assure that they won't be that quality or that quality won't show up that they fear being known for. So that's basically what happens.
I mean, to really oversimplify and to use a cliche, we're kind of almost talking like self-fulfilling prophecies.
It's absolutely a self-fulfilling prophecy. They make something up, and then they create the evidence to make it real.
So that's really interesting. And so when you talk about the first part about the, you know, the spanking or a scolding or something like that, now that's not, is that making something up, or is that something that kind of gets imposed externally, or is it a combination of both?
That's an example of buying into someone else's low opinion of them.
Okay.
So someone else insults them or bullies them or hits them or whatever that is, that, you know, the parent says, you know, you lazy, good for nothing, you don't clean up your room, or, you know, you're stupid, don't you know any better? Then they buy into that. You know, someone that is an authority figure that they hold in high regard, like a parent says that I'm stupid, I must be stupid. So now they become stupid. They start to hold themselves as stupid. They start to look for evidence to support that they're stupid. They take things, they study things that they don't know. Maybe they don't study enough. Whatever it is, they reinforce that initial notion until they're absolutely convinced that they're stupid.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it works the other way, too, because I know that I was fortunate enough to have parents that always kind of told me that I was pretty bright and intelligent and could therefore learn things well. And so I guess it does kind of, you create the kind of reverse of self, positive self-fulfilling prophecy too.
Well, absolutely. And that's what parents can do with children. They can edify them. They can acknowledge what they do well. They can separate out the bad behavior from being a bad person. They can do all sorts of things that will allow their children to see that they're unconditionally loved, that they have value no matter what, and that everyone has weaknesses that can be worked upon to be built into strengths, and that it's not that it makes anyone better than anyone else. It's just that we all have gifts, and that we all need to make the most of the gifts that we were given, and we need to work on the areas that there are missing elements for.
So parents, I mean, can correct children and can help guide them into positive behaviors, but also do it in a way that does not have a negative impact on their self-esteem.
Absolutely. Parents will have a huge impact in nurturing and building self-esteem. And it's possible that even with great parents who are absolutely committed to nurturing the self-esteem of their children, although these children will have a much greater probability of developing high self-esteem, it's still possible and likely that they will make things up about themselves that damage their self-esteem. Again, it could be outside of the home, it could be whatever it is, but as parents continue to nurture that self-esteem, offer the unconditional love, to acknowledge their children for things, they consistently reinforce that self-confidence that we were speaking of initially, and that builds the self-esteem.
Yeah, that's so interesting because I've often joked that the school system, at least in the United States, seems I went through Catholic elementary school, seemed very focused on sort of telling us what was wrong with us and how bad we were, as opposed to what was right with us and how good we were.
Yes, I've had that experience too.
And I can tell you something even more amusing. When I was accepted to Harvard to begin my doctoral program, I can remember going to orientation, and the faculty would come in and say, well, I'm sure everybody here thinks that they're an admissions mistake. And I thought, what a bizarre thing to say to people. And finally, I got tired of it after two or three weeks even hearing it in class, and I finally raised my hand one day and said, well, I don't think I am. I assumed that I wrote a good application and I should have been accepted. But, I mean, it was even at that level where, you know, you had people who were in their 20s and 30s who had been accepted at a, pretty good institution of higher learning, and having faculty, you know, saying these things that are really very damaging to self-esteem. I mean, for maybe some people did think they were an admissions mistake, and that certainly would be a tough thing to hear coming from the faculty.
Well, you know, so many of the world's people are totally unaware of what it takes to build self-esteem, have high self-esteem themselves, and to support others to feel good about who they are. And so as a result, we have wars, we have high divorce rates, we have ineffective communication, we have conflicts everywhere, we have unhappiness, we have lack of respect. We have negative emotions flying everywhere. We have reactions of anger and sadness and fear. All of that is a function of low self-esteem.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, so here we are. You know, we've been talking a little bit about, parents and, I guess, schools. But, you know, as we start dealing with people, you're dealing with people, you know, in business. I'm sure people say to you, okay, Joe, well, you know, I'm 25, 30, 40, and the damage has been done. What do I need to do now to try to break some of this cycle of self-esteem so I can actually feel good about myself? What do
I do? Well, it's never too late. One of the ways out of that vicious cycle we lay out in step-by-step fashion in the self-esteem system program that we have, and there are basically three components. The first is healing and completing your past, where you no longer carry around misconceptions that you made up about yourself as a child. So if there were abusive episodes or there were traumatic incidences or there were upsets or broken relationships or any pain from the past, that becomes healed. You no longer carry that weight of the world on your shoulders. And people that I've worked in the coaching relationship with, in a matter of an hour session, they lose decades of pain and suffering and beating themselves up and regret and all of the rest. You do that by reinterpreting history. One of the things that we believe is that you can't change history, but we are not aware of history, history being the facts as if reported by Joe Friday. This is what happened. What we do remember is what we felt about it, what we made up about the other person, what we made up about ourselves, what we made up about the world in general. So there are all of these misinterpretations that we made up, that we carry over, that we magnify with each subsequent upset. And before you know it, we have this whole story made up about what happened to us and how life has been cruel and people don't like us or we don't fit in or whatever that story is about us in relation to other people. And it's all made up. It's all manifesting our worst fears.
So you go back and you help people try to be a little more objective about their history?
Well, we have them totally reinterpret. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was saying to be able to assign different interpretations to what actually happened. To separate. I guess what I'm hearing you say is it's important to separate what happened from how you felt about it.
Yeah, and what you made up about yourself and others in the process. So that's one of the exercises, and there are a number of others in completion with, for example, difficult people or abusive situations or traumatic situations where it's a whole system of undoing the interpretations that have landed you in the soup, so to speak, of low self-esteem. So once you clear up those lingering negative ties to the past, you now assess your present situation in your present state. So you look at these six areas of life that I mentioned. You look at what's working in each area and what's missing that if put into place would support that area to be more effective. You look at all of your values. Are they being honored? You look at your gifts. Are they being manifest into the world? You declare who you are because you say so. You make a decision and a declaration that you are these qualities. And if I was loving and contributing and creative and a great friend, how would I act in this situation? So you stop living your life based on the evidence that you've created, saying that you're a loner, you're a bad friend, you're an abusive spouse, you're whatever that is that has got you here, and you start living from a declaration of who you say that you are. And then you design your future in choice according to that declaration, where every aspect of your life works optimally, where you honor your values in all six areas, where you actually start to design your life on purpose as if you had a magic wand. You could wave it over your life and you could say, these are the people that I'm living with. This is where I'm living. This is what I'm doing on a daily basis. This is what I'm, the qualities that I'm known for and who I'm being. These are the people I'm contributing to. Every single aspect of your life gets laid out in a vision, and then you start to step into that vision through action.
That's really interesting as you speak about it, because sometimes that may be more doing what you're talking about there, which is very affirmative and taking responsibility for yourself, may actually be more difficult or frustrating for some people than sort of being in the low self-esteem place where you can blame it on other people. Yeah, if you start taking responsibility for yourself, you can't blame it on other people. You have to look at yourself when things don't go as well as you'd like.
Well, that's one of the reasons why people keep it in place, because they get to be a victim. They get to feel sorry for themselves. They get to evoke the sympathy of others. And they get to live small. They get to have all sorts of excuses why the world is mean to them and cruel, and they haven't got enough money, and life isn't fair, and you know, all of those things that keep it in place, as opposed to saying, okay, this is what's so, this is what do I need to do about it to get my needs met and to live a life of choice, as opposed to being the victim. So you can't have both. You can't be responsible and be a victim at the same time.
Yeah. When you're a victim, you're kind of emotionally unaware, I take it.
You absolutely are. You're unaware of your lack of ability to respond, your lack of involvement in your situation. You know, we have it that all of what we attract to us is our creation. And, you know, we're co-creating that with God, with other people. And it's not fault or blame, but in this case, responsibility is about what am I doing to bring these situations into my life. I have it that everything that happens to us is for a reason. There is a learning opportunity in everything. And until we learn those lessons, we're going to constantly bring these sorts of things into our lives. And once we've learned them, we can move on to another area. So as long as we are not taking responsibility for manifesting the things that we want, and so if we want to be happy, we don't focus on sadness. If we want to have rich relationships, we don't focus on anger. If we want to be fulfilled, we don't focus on negativity. If we want to be abundant, we don't focus on scarcity. So it's that sort of thing, and when we can train ourselves to actually manifest the things that we want, we now can see that we can create the kind of life that we really would love to have if we had the courage to pursue it.
So you're talking about, you know, not learning a lesson. So in other words, if tough stuff, bad stuff, whatever, happens over and over, is it too simple for me to suggest that I haven't learned the lesson that I was to learn about this tough stuff or bad stuff that keeps happening over and over, and that's why it keeps happening over and over.
It's a place to look. You know, good people have bad things happen to them, and mm-hmm. so this isn't an accusation. It's not blame. But what mm-hmm. it is it's a place where I would ask myself, who am I being that these sorts of people are coming into my life all the time? Who am mm-hmm. I being that I'm attracting poverty? Who am I being that I'm always in conflicts with people? And so that is what it means to be responsible, because when we ask a question like that, we can start to look at having a breakthrough in being different so that we can attract different.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And it's really sometimes that simple.
Yeah, and so in other words, if I find myself surrounded with jerks, I probably should ask myself, well, why are all these jerks around me? As opposed to, how can I get rid of all of them? That I need to take the responsibility to figure out, why is it that I attract people that I find difficult or unpleasant or hard to be around?
Absolutely. You know, it's not accusatory. What mm-hmm. it is we have brought every aspect of our life into being. We have created it on some level. And so as a result, we have the ability to create something different if all we have to do is look around us and see what is manifesting in our lives. And if we don't like what it is, we can create a new vision of what we want to manifest by having a different expectation of what our life is going to be like, because mm-hmm. we are motivated in alignment with that expectation. We are motivated to bring something into being if we absolutely believe we can accomplish it. And if we believe that we won't, we will self-sabotage. That's why someone who is, let's say, playing a great golf game and they're leading the pack after 9 holes, their negative self-talk starts kicking in saying, you know, I'm playing way over my head. This can't last. These people are better than I am. I don't know how I've developed this lead. And before you know it, he or she starts to choke because you don't expect to be where you want to be. And so it's kind of like a thermostat that kicks in to bring you to the level of your expectation.
You know, I'm reading Pete Sampras' book. I had a birthday last week, and my wife gave it to me for my birthday. And I'm a huge tennis fan, and Sampras was a great player. And he talks about that a lot in the early part of his book, that it took him a while. He had to get over his negative self-talk, especially about winning Grand Slam events, and to allow him to become at least at this point, the person who has won more Grand Slam titles than anybody in history. And he makes that exact point in many different ways and in many different times throughout the book. So it's clear that it was a huge thing for him, that he had to realize that he had a lot of negative self-talk, particularly when it came to winning the huge events. He was almost saying, yeah, I can win these smaller tournaments, but the big ones, somehow they elude me. Mm-hmm. And so listening to what you're saying exactly matches up with what I've been reading in his book.
That is right on, and we all do it to some extent, where mm-hmm. when we don't expect to win, we somehow create that self-fulfilling prophecy. And, you know, one other thing, Bud, is that when we expect more of the same, when we expect to make about the same amount of money that we made last year, when we expect to have about the same amount of vacations or same amount of friends or whatever that is expectation-wise, we mm-hmm. create that apathetic expectation level to manifest what we've always had. So, again, like the thermostat, we start to make a little bit of improvement, but then we start to self-sabotage when we, you know, we get ahead. Maybe we take it a little easy and say, oh, this was good. I can relax. I can rest now because I've earned it. We create creative justifications for returning to the status quo.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting, again, not to talk too much about this Sampras book, but he talked about one of his coaches told him, if you're up 40 love in the game, don't think that it's okay to lose the next point or the next 2 points because you can still win the game. If you're up 40 love, do whatever you can to make sure that you close out the game right away. And I think that's the kind of thing that you're talking about in terms of the thermostat kicking in and easing off.
Yes. I mean, you see it in baseball games all the time. Just a couple of nights ago, I was watching a Red Sox game where they were up 12-2, 10-0, 12-2. They ended up winning something like, I think it was 19-17. But what happens is they start to become complacent. They say, oh, we've got a huge lead. We can take it easy. They start to – they actually replaced a couple of their first-string players with second-string players, thinking that, oh, this is an easy way to take give them the night off. Before they know it, they had to come back in the last inning because they just about gave up the game. So we have to always be on our guard not to give up on our expectations, because our expectations deliver what manifests in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you what, they didn't take any innings off in the World Series against the Rockies last year. Of course, the Rockies played a little over their head to get there. You know, one of the things that you know that you talk about, and I've read you know some of your stuff, is that two really important things for raising self-esteem are empathy and forgiveness. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, absolutely. They're the most critical. Empathy is about putting yourself in the other person's shoes. What is it like in their world that would have them say or do what they do? And when we can appreciate what it's like in the other person's world, we can now take the upset away from us. We can understand why people do mean, crazy, selfish, hurtful things. It's about the way they see the world. It has nothing to do with us, even though they called us a fat, stupid, ignorant kid, whatever. Mm-hmm. So when we can have empathy for others, we can take the upset away, which helps to maintain our own high self-esteem. We also can go to the next level, which is forgiveness, which is forgiving people for making mistakes. And, of course, we have to start by forgiving ourselves. When we can forgive ourselves, we can now look at others as doing the best they know how to do based upon their insecurities, their distorted perceptions, their imperfect ways of seeing situations. And when we can appreciate that everyone is trying to survive, just as we are, we can now forgive them for the things that they do that are hurtful or mean or unkind or whatever. And I like to think of forgiving as thank you for giving me the opportunity to experience something to help me to grow in wisdom and in empathy for others.
Say that again, so people can hear it.
Sure. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to experience this, because I learned something that will allow me to grow in empathy and in wisdom concerning my relationship with others.
Great play on words there, and I think that's really true. And I guess they're so intimately tied in that if we can develop empathy for people and try to understand why someone acts the way he or she does, whether it's positive or negative, it makes it easier to forgive them for maybe some of the hurtful things that they've done to us.
Well, it always does. And the other thing that's really key that we didn't talk about today is our emotional response to situations. When we have empathy for what it's like for other people to do what they do, it allows us to detach from their words or their actions so that we no longer are at the effect of them. We all have a predominant emotional response to life, and it starts early on when we were in that young initial situation of where our self-esteem was first damaged. And it's been recreated hundreds or thousands of times since. And that emotional response is a function of anger, sadness, or fear. For most people, it's anger, but for some people, it very rapidly deteriorates to sadness, which can look like depression. And for others, fear, which looks like worrying all the time about things. And so when we can identify that predominant emotion showing up, we can recognize that there's some mischief going on in how we're seeing things. And when we have empathy for what it's like in the other person's world, we can now take the assault away from that interpretation so that it doesn't damage our self-esteem, so that we don't react in the way that we're inclined to based upon our predominant mood of anger, sadness, or fear. Mm-hmm. And that is huge, because when we can start to manage our emotional response to life, we can be proactively in control of how we see things, how we respond to things. And it gives us huge personal power. And it just, it also supports our relationships, and it supports us to not be at the effect of what other people say or do all the time.
So this idea of managing, you know, our emotional responses, I guess that's one place to start if you're trying to design your future with high self-esteem?
It's absolutely a great place to start. The third quality besides empathy and forgiveness that I'd even suggest is gratitude. You know, we mm-hmm. can't be grateful for something and feel sorry for ourselves at the same time. So most of us don't acknowledge the things that we do well nearly enough. We don't acknowledge other people nearly enough. We're not in tune with the things that we have in our lives that are working that we should be grateful for. And if we can focus on that gratitude as opposed to the negativity, what's missing, instead of not looking at what's missing but looking at what's working, if we can start to look for the things that we want to make large, we can now focus on that law of attraction to attract the things that we want by being grateful for them, by doing more of the things that manifest them, by supporting our communication with other people so that we're more effective in creating the things that we want. All of that happens when we start to manage our thinking and manage our emotional responses and manage our communication.
Empathy, forgiveness, gratitude. You know, it's interesting. I used to hear people talk about being grateful for, you know, having a disease, say like cancer, and I always thought, well, that's kind of strange. And then, interestingly enough, I had thyroid cancer about 10, 12 years ago. Hmm. And when I do a lot of reflection on my life and to kind of realize how precious life is and what I would want to do, how I wanted to move forward once, you know, the problem with the cancer was cleared up. And sure enough, it was cleared up, and I've been cancer-free. Mm-hmm. But it really was something for which I was grateful, and that it really gave me pause to think about my life up until that point. And how would I feel about myself if it did end, and what I could do going forward, because it was sort of like a wake-up call about the fragility of life. So it was interesting. I really came to, I guess that's more sympathy, not even empathy, because I understood it for real because it happened to me. I had trouble empathizing with people who talked about being grateful for having a disease like cancer.
Well, that is a great example where you look at what most would consider as a horrible situation. You look for the good in it. You look at, why am I attracting this to me? What can I learn from it? How can I use it to improve my life? How can I be more grateful for life? All of those things can make something like that a gift, even though at the time, it can, most people would easily interpret it as anything but a gift.
It was funny for me. I mean, it kind of made me kind of look and say, well, you know, if the worst happened here, I'm okay, because I think I've achieved a fair bit in my life. I think most people who know me would say I'm a pretty good guy. I've been helpful to people. And so it made me feel kind of good about myself. And then it also, you know, made me realize that, you know, I have a lot of gifts, and I need to use those gifts to the best of my ability as I go forward. So it was a very interesting experience for me.
Yes.
Joe, you're incredibly articulate as you speak about this, and I know that you have it's an audio recording. I think it's called The 7 Steps to Self-Esteem.
Yes, The 7 Steps to Soaring Self-Esteem.
Mm-hmm. How do people get that?
Well, it's free, and if you visit if you go to selfesteemsystem.com, you can get not only the 7 Steps to Soaring Self-Esteem audio, but there's a free membership that's worth about $129 to what we call the Success Achievers Club. And there's a mini self-esteem course there. There are e-books and audios and free offers and discounted offers and all sorts of great things that champion people to be their best.
www.selfesteemsystem.com.
Correct.
No dashes or anything at all like
nope,
that.
Nope, one word, selfesteemsystem.com.
And then people get can get your newsletter. If they go there, they get your newsletter and everything.
Yeah, we have two newsletters. One comes with that entry of their first name and their email address at selfesteemsystem.com. The other, if you go to www.drjoerubino.com, that takes you to my main website, which is the Center for Personal Reinvention, where you can read about my books and tapes and coaching services, and you'll see that you can sign up for my business and personal development newsletter there. So there's actually two different free services that we offer people out of our commitment to have them be their best.
Okay. So that one is Dr. D-R J-O-E Rubino, R-U-B-I-N-O.com.
Correct.
DrJoeRubino.com. And then I take it that on that site, the Dr. Joe Rubino site, people can also find out about how if they would want to work with you personally in one-to-one coaching or group coaching, that's the site to go where they can learn about that.
Yes, there's a link called coaching there that they click on and they will learn all about our coaching program. And we coach people both in business and in personal development and in self-esteem issues. So there's extensive coaching. I've studied coaching for more than 9 years before becoming a coach. I'm certified as a coach in life planning, and so I've worked with literally thousands of individuals, both in business and in personal development and self-esteem issues.
Well, you know, we've talked a lot about self-esteem here and as it relates to self-confidence and as it relates to, you know, success in your life and your career. You've really been very generous with your time and your information. You know, I always like to ask people, what did I not ask you that I should have asked you that's important about all this stuff?
Well, that's a great question. What I'd like to just leave people with is that if you are not living your life of choice, if you are resigned in any way, if you are suffering or struggling, you know, suffering is having something we don't want or wanting something we don't have. And if that describes you in any way, if you feel like you're unable to have it all, abundantly, wealth production, rich relationships, great friends, warm family relationships, if you're unable to be happy about what you're doing for your life's work, all of those things are symptoms of resignation. And so if you were like me back in 1990, before I was introduced to the whole concept of personal development, I was very resigned. I was a dentist who, although I was making a lot of money, I was not very happy, thinking that dentistry was the only thing that I could do to earn an income for my family. So long story short, I discovered a personal development program, took a year-long program, continued in the area of personal development under a number of mentors for the next 9 years, learning to be a coach, learning to be able to support people to support others. And so my invitation to everyone listening to us today is that if you are not living your best life, if you have not declared who you are because you say so, but instead you're living on the past disempowering evidence that has kept you small or stuck or living in that resignation, I invite you to have the courage to take that first step now. There are tools available. There are coaching services available. There are self-study guides available. You know, our Center for Personal Reinvention is just one tool that's available. I invite people to pick up the free offers that we mentioned. I invite people to not be resigned but to take action, because the key to manifesting, to attracting the things that we want, starts with action. It can be imperfect action. It doesn't have to be just right. You know, some people, Bud, will not act until they find in their minds the absolute certainty that they've chosen the right way to go it. That is not what's important. What's important is to take some baby steps in the direction of your vision for your life. Be clear about what that vision is. And so I'm inviting people not to live in that resignation, but to take action today and to actually know that you can manifest whatever it is that you want in life. And I just invite people to have the courage to take some affirmative direction in the alignment with their vision. And I thank everyone for listening today.